Group meeting, Saturday, 14th December, 1985. Last time, we stopped at that quotation from the Tejobindu Upanishad, where Shiva says to his disciple, "I am of the nature of Parabrahman. I am the I that has given up I." See, the separate selfhood is completely out. "I am beyond the reach of mind and speech." And he ends up by saying, "I am of the nature of the all void." Whenever the void is mentioned, and in this case the all void, it doesn't mean an absolute vacuity. It means that there is nothing in existence which limits and misrepresents the ultimate reality. Void in the ordinary sense, in its meaning for us in the religious context, means essentially void of all evil. It also means void of all what we call good. Now this may sound rather peculiar, but the fact of the matter is that all that we call good or evil is relative to the absolute reality. And it is void of all relativity. Hence its context, the infinite and the eternal, remains untarnished. It is the all light. And Shiva goes on, "I am the unconditioned, the permanent, the unborn." Now, here it's rather interesting to notice the number of times the unborn is mentioned in all the Upanishadic writings. It starts right from the times of the Rig Veda, and it extends into the Upanishadic literature too. And the Buddha, when he gives that marvelous autobiographical discourse, the Ariya Pariyesana Sutta, it's number 26 in the first volume, he says to his bhikkhus, "Seeking the unborn, I won the unborn." Of course, the verbal expression is rather inadequate, almost absurd. How can anybody seek the unborn? The non-existent cannot be sought by us human beings in our ordinary finite and temporal state of consciousness. It is not there. And if you came across it, how would you ever recognize it? But then that is the trouble with language. All language is futile in the light of the Supreme. Then Sri Krishna in the Gita, it's the 14th discourse, verse 27, he says, "I am the abode of Brahman, the immortal, the inexhaustible, of eternal righteousness and unending bliss." If Brahman is the absolute all, as the Hindu scriptures present it, how can I, the finite mortal, be the abode of Brahman? Now you see, it is that sort of statement which gives the clue to the fact that the context of the holistic consciousness, the supreme consciousness which is possible for man to realize, that is a consciousness which functions in terms of the infinite and the eternal. And if so, then one can say, I am the abode of Brahman. That is to say, the person in that holistic consciousness becomes conscious of the one total reality as a whole, as something altogether complete. That sort of consciousness, I feel, is really the evolutionary end of the human species, the realization of that sort of consciousness. Then Sri Krishna says, I am seated in the hearts of all. Well, this is, of course, equivalent to what I've said so often, that transcendence is embodied in each and every one of us. Because I am beyond the perishable, and even beyond the imperishable, in this world and in the Veda, I am proclaimed the Spirit Supreme. Beyond the perishable and beyond the imperishable. Because whatsoever is perishable is so because we are conscious in the manner in which we are conscious. If we were holistically conscious, nothing perishes, nothing dies, nothing is born, nothing ever comes into manifestation. The consciousness which embraces the totality is absolute in the real sense. There is no beginning, proceeding, ending, and so forth. There is no here, there, or anything like that. It is because we are conscious only in terms of the finite and the temporal, therefore for us, things, people, whatever there is manifest, comes into being and perishes. And then, beyond the imperishable, man postulates imperishability. And I think that in this context, that is the meaning there. Sri Krishna says, I am beyond human conception of the imperishable. Hence, I am proclaimed the Spirit Supreme. Then, let us see what Al-Hallaj, the great Muslim mystic, said. You know, he was very cruelly crucified for saying these things. If you do not recognize God, at least recognize his signs. I am that sign. I am the creative truth. An al-haq, he said. Because through the truth, I am a truth eternally. It's a marvelous statement. And of course the Muslims did him in very, very cruelly. Muhammad declared, God, there is no God but He, the living, the eternal. neither slumber seizeth him nor sleep. His whatsoever is in the heavens and whatsoever is in the earth. He knoweth what hath been before them and what shall be after them. Yet naught of his knowledge will they grasp, save what he willeth. It is again a strange statement. Man comes to know only what is allowed him to know by the Supreme. What could be one of the important significances of that? The Supreme is the Absolute. Man is the finite and temporal. And that finitude and temporality in man brings about filling his psyche with all that which really should be emptied from the psyche. And the emptying is a process which is somewhat unique to each individual. And because it is unique to that individual, that particular response, which in a sense is a limited response, can come from the Absolute to the individual. So although several people may realize holistic consciousness, those several people will express in their several different ways the results of experiencing holistic consciousness. Notice carefully how the founders of the great religions, all of them spoke the truth. But the form, when you speak something, you try to present truth in a particular form. That form is original and unique to the presenter. There is no once and for all absolute form in which to present the truth. If one realizes that, one would never quarrel, never argue with anybody about anything. There is no room for conflict, for struggle, for harmfulness. And the history of the religions of the world, as far as the followers of the religions are concerned, is in so many ways, not always, but in so many ways, rather a sad story. All the religious wars and the cruelties practiced by the upholders of religion, priests and so on, things like the Inquisition and so forth. That sort of thing would never take place if one just understood this. Because one would be able, not merely intellectual fiat, but one would be really able, with one's whole being, to accept anything, everything. Nothing is out of your embrace. And then there is peace. That is in the that bit from spoken by Muhammad is in the Quran, verse 256 of the second surah, as it is called. Then he also says, "This is God, your Lord. There is no God but He, the Creator of all things. Therefore, worship Him alone." And He watcheth over all things. The holistic consciousness completely holds everything within its grasp. Holds without necessarily giving it separate form. It can have distinctive form. It is that distinctiveness, that characteristic expression, which enables one to see, yes, this person has realized holistic consciousness. No vision taketh in him. Now this is absolutely a terrific statement. No vision taketh in him. But he taketh in all vision. And he is the subtle and the translation is spelt S-U-B-T-I-L-E, the subtile. Like in Genesis, the serpent was subtile. You see. But he is not subtile in that sense. He's subtle. There is nothing limited. It is all spirit. And he is the all-informed. Now, I go on. Many are the forms of the affirmation. This chapter is the affirmation and the promise. And the affirmation, as we have seen so far throughout all these months, is the affirmation of the actuality of a holistic consciousness, the actuality of its functioning in terms of the infinite and the eternal. And this has been made throughout the centuries. It's not new. I have tried to give it a modern form, because we live in a scientific age in which the key word is energy. Fundamental energy, creative energy, the primordial energy. But when I use the word energy in this religious context, it includes all that we know of the various energies that science has been able to investigate. Electricity, magnetism, heat, chemical energy, etc., etc., gravitational energy and all the rest of it. You see? Those I would class as material energies, so to say. Of course, electricity isn't material, except in so far that an electric current is a stream of electrons. That's what it actually is. A stream of electrons, particles of negative electricity. The trouble is with the wording, particles. The moment we say particles, what happens in our brain? We see something solid and extremely small. That's the particle. But it is solid matter. And it is because of that tendency, I concede to the scientific investigation of the various energies we know of as material energies. Now, so such are the affirmations. What is the promise? In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, Yajnavalkya says, "He who is free from desire, whose desire finds fulfillment, since the Atma is his desire, the powers of life leave him not. Being one with Brahman, in Brahman he abides." This must not be mistaken for physical immortality, bodily immortality. Note carefully, he who is free from desire, desire in all the forms that we ordinary mortals express desire, and then he says, whose desire finds fulfillment since the Atman is his desire. This comes in several Upanishads, not only in the Brihadaranyaka. If your desire is the desire for the real, for the ultimate reality, the truth, the absolute, then that can be fulfilled during your lifetime. And in that fulfillment, you experience the real meaning of immortality, the deathless state. What did the Buddha promise in his opening words? Hearken, bhikkhus, the deathless has been found. If you go on as I teach, you will also find it here and now in this life, he says quite openly. The powers of life leave him not. Now that, of course, as I said a few seconds ago, does not mean physical immortality. All that belongs in the way of capacity to do the best thing, the perfect thing, is hidden within our own constitution. And remember that our own constitution is not merely a material constitution to which is added some mysterious spark called the spark of divinity or immortal soul or a little bit of something. The moment the brain thinks in that way, it's thinking wrongly. If it can think in terms of totality all along the line, then all these scriptures will suddenly light up in the most remarkable manner. And you will actually experience, if only for the fraction of a second, that extraordinary peace and immensity, and an immensity of power, of all-inclusiveness, which is transcendent love and perfect wisdom at the same time. The human constitution is a microcosm. The whole cosmos manifested as a particular organism. The brain cannot picture this. Don't try to picture it by just thinking. It will happen to you as and when the brain stops talking. You are really quiet, and that lightning flash of transcendence just lights up your whole temporal being. Then you really know the meaning of eternity and infinity without any concepts and words attached to it. That knowledge, that kind of knowledge, is the real meaning of the word vidya. Vidya in Pali, vidya in Sanskrit. That is knowledge. Its root is vid, meaning to see. Now, of course, physically, it is physical sight, vid. But this seeing is a transcendent seeing. Because of its transcendence, it is not a seeing similar to or analogous with a physical seeing with the eyes. It is seeing by being what you see. Now you look at a wall when you go home. Look at the wall of your room and see if you can become the wall. Well, of course, physically you can never become the wall. However wall-like some people may be. But there we are. You become the wall because your consciousness undergoes that peculiar transformation which makes it holistic. The wall is not just a separate something. You are it. It is you. This is the mystery of holistic consciousness. I can't say anything more about it. When all desires that cling to the heart, the desires cling to the heart, it's not merely that I desire something as such, but the desire gets hold of me, clings on to me. I've dealt with that sort of thing much later on in the book, towards the end. when all desires that cling to the heart disappear, then a mortal becomes immortal in consciousness. In holistic consciousness, you experience, you realize immortality. But all the people who realize immortality, every one of them physically died. There's no getting away from that. Every single one of them. Although some of the scriptures have absurd statements. I know one, for example, in the Zarathustrian scriptures, where one Dastu, that is a high priest, who was a very holy man, is said to have gone away into the mountains and he lives immortally in his body. And when the day comes, he will once again come and spread the teaching. All that is sheer nonsense. Just wishful thinking. They say the same of one of the kings who was a great king of Iran of the old days. If he is really there, I wish he would come and deal with the Ayatollah. Then a mortal becomes immortal, and even in this life attains liberation. Just as the Buddha said, here in this life you realize deathlessness. While we are here in this life, we may reach the light of wisdom. And if we reach it not, how deep is the darkness? And unfortunately, that's the fate of the 5,000 millions on the globe, more or less. You see, the human race may be compared to a vast tree with all its leaves in the autumn. And what happens? They just fall. It's true that they fall, they die, and nourish the earth thereby. They nourish Mother Earth. The sere leaf has gone through its particular cycle of manifestation, but has never been able to reach that supreme unmanifested state of immortality. So the leaf as a leaf must necessarily fall and die. Try and understand this in the real sense, not just intellectually. But when brain and heart together really get the whole feel of it, then the fear of death and all the associated fears just vanish altogether. What is that statement? O death, where is thy victory? O grave? No, something. Where is thy sting?
Where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory?
Yes. O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory? Then you realize that. And in that state, you're always quiet, you're always inwardly at peace. A peculiar peace which nothing can shake. However tired one may be, however annoying the external circumstance may be, you are you with a capital Y, capital O, capital U. That's that. And that's the complete fulfillment, not of the person John Smith, but of transcendence manifesting through humanity. You know, in the Christian scriptures they always say, unto God the glory. That's what it means. It's not for me or anything to do with me. It's the totality, the supreme. See, one of the beautiful fruits of this sort of realization is that you become harmless in the real sense. Whatsoever happens, you are able to take it in your stride. our good and evil is a relative good and evil. And so when we hear or see anything evil done, what happens in the brain? Uprises anger, condemnation, and etc., etc. All that disappears. Mind you, it's very hard when somebody has suffered some of the most terrible things that people can suffer. What's happening in modern times, all these rapes which go on and so forth. And the terrible scar that is left on the psyche thereby, almost unhealable. No one from outside can heal it. Only from within oneself it can be healed. So it is. But with that profundity of understanding, which is compassionate wisdom and which is wise love, the psyche does get healed of that terrible happening. Those who see the light enter life eternal. Again, only in terms of consciousness. Those who live in darkness enter sorrow. You know, these Upanishadic teachings are some of the supreme teachings that we have in the world. The Buddha was a great technician. He sort of pointed the way, pointed many ways as a matter of fact. These people just stated the actuality of the realization, but they stated it with such intellectual genius that whoever really penetrates the words realizes what they stand for. The Aitareya Upanishad, which is the oldest of the Upanishads, short one, says, Vamadeva, who was the great seer, poet seer, who wrote the fourth book of the Rig Veda, the hymns of the fourth book, he, Vamadeva, having ascended aloft from this world, became immortal. Yea, became immortal. Now compare this with a statement in the Acts of the Apostles. Even while he was speaking, he was taken aloft into the clouds, and that was that. You know, the ascension of Jesus has been presented that way. But the Upanishad gives the necessary hints as regards how one ascends aloft. One is no longer tied to this limited state. But that doesn't mean that you leave the limited state. The complete purification of the psychophysical organism as a whole brings it into that state whereby in consciousness you realize these things. You transform the body that is ill into the body that is perfectly well. Became immortal. Yea, became immortal. The Katha Upanishad says, he who has understanding, who is mindful and ever pure, reaches the end of the journey from which he never returns. Again, words can be misleading. A statement like that, naturally, one interprets it in terms of one's physical experience. You start on a journey, and you reach the end of that journey. The brain ordinarily sees it in static terms. We moved from here, we went there, which was our goal, and then we stayed there and had Christmas dinner afterwards. See, it's nothing like that at all. Nothing like that. The end of the journey means that the whole process of purification has been completed. But when it is completed, the realization of holistic consciousness is an activity, a journey, but with no movement anywhere. It is here and now, the eternal now, as who was the Christian mystic who coined that phrase, Taula? The eternal now is a realization, and in that eternal now, there is continuous creation. The activity of the primordial creative energy never ceases. It's perpetually creative. It never ceases. So, the end of the journey is, for the individual as such, in the manner in which a particular individual can experience it, which is a limited manner after all. You see, the end of the journey is this complete oneness with this creative energy. What I have called in this book, creative action in eternity. There is no movement there. There is no end product there. There is no loss. There is no gain. There is no happiness. There is no joy. It is in that absolute state. One can see why those old teachers kept all this sort of thing esoteric. Because say this to the man in the street, a good man, an intelligent man in the street, what will he make of it? He will probably call upon God, say, "My God, what's all this about? Can't follow it." Well, of course one can't follow it. It is realized here, straight away. Or it is not realized. Depends upon the extent to which the man is purified. Then, Nachiketas, and I think I said last time that the name Nachiketas means the unknowing one. And it's the Lord of Death, Yamaraja. Yamaraja, who teaches him all this. What did Parsifal do? Through great suffering, experience, and purification, he finally won the spear which was lost, which would heal the wound from which Amfortas was dying. And Parsifal means the pure fool. Then Nachiketas, having received this knowledge declared by death and the whole teaching of yoga, not just asanas and pranayama, which is, of course, the sort of, like the foundation of a house, the basic thing, that's all. But the other things are far and away the more important. And do remember that in yoga there, the asanas are preceded by the yamas and the niyamas. That is the living of the holy life in the real sense. Attained, Nachiketas attained Brahman and became free from passion, immortal. And so may any other who knows this in regard to the Atma. Now, realize again, bear in mind again, knows this, not this, not mere brain knowledge, not just a mass of intellectual concepts and so forth, but knows it by becoming it. The Kena Upanishad says, when known by an awakening. Here one can tie this up with the Buddha's teaching. Awake, awake, the Buddha teaches all along the line, doesn't he? To awaken to this state. When known by an awakening, it, capital I, it is conceived of. That is, the conception follows after the realization in the deeps of consciousness. Because, I have said again and again at our meetings, once you have been touched by this lightning flash of transcendence, it brings about such a transformation in your inner nature that sooner or later it will take shape in terms of a concept or a set of concepts, and the appropriate words will go with it. Krishnaji said, I think it's in the second volume of his life, that the words will come. When known by an awakening, it is conceived of. Truly, it is immortality one finds. The freedom from death. The Kaushitaki Upanishad, having reached that, he becomes immortal as the gods are immortal. The Mundaka Upanishad, he verily who knows that supreme Brahman becomes very Brahman. He crosses over sorrow. He crosses over sin. Liberated from the knots of the heart, K-N-O-T-S, from the knots of the heart, he becomes immortal. So you see, obviously it doesn't mean physical immortality at all. It's the realization of the actuality, the nature, if you like, of immortality in consciousness which is there. And once it is fully realized, it is there with you always. It never departs. It remains as the permanent background, expressing itself throughout every single thought and feeling, word and deed. That is why those people were, as to use the Buddha's phrase, they were called the perfected holy ones. You know how, for instance, we say of an artist, say a pianist, oh, he is a perfect pianist. No pianist is ever a perfect pianist.